Hello, and welcome to Ancient and Medieval History. I am your host, Catherine Loomis. The music you have just heard, the song title is Falat Fran Lima. It's by Barry Phillips, and you can find it on his album Trod, which is listed at magnatune.com. There, any money that you donate, half of it goes directly to the artist, and they're a very good institution. We will also hear a little more of this song at the end of this podcast. Now, before I start this week's episode, I must explain something on my opinion of history. While facts and figures are great, they don't give us the personality of our ancestors. They simply state when and where an event happened, and possibly how many people were involved in it. I feel that literature is also a very important part of history. While scholars, clergy, and politicians wrote plenty of texts, they were usually written in a more restrained and proper tone. Fiction took more liberties and was able to show what the common man was like. He who was not able to normally record his ideas like an educated man. Fiction could also show how people spoke. Throughout the Middle Ages, Latin was usually used by the clergy for writing, yet most people spoke some variation of English, or at least in England. I look at Charles Dickens's writing, and I can almost hear the London street urchin as I pick through the cockney of the characters in Oliver Twist. I read Chaucer and I can see the wife of Bath with all her attitude. Literature is very important to our history. Okay, I'll get off my little soapbox now and on to the episode. This week's episode deals with the old English epic, Beowulf. See, there was a point to my rambling. The tale is believed to have been written any time between the middle of the 7th century and the end of the 10th century. Only one manuscript has survived as far as scholars today are aware. So it's pretty much pure luck that we even know about this tale. This one manuscript was discovered in the 18th century after it barely survived a fire. Even now, there are a few pieces of the tale missing, and the edge of some of the pages are charred. Yet, even though Beowulf is a fairly newly discovered text, it has become one of the most important standards for English scholars. J.R.R. Tolkien, who's of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings fame, was also a professor of English language, and is one of the many figures to actually translate and study Beowulf. In fact, there are a few elements of Beowulf that probably influenced Tolkien when he wrote his novels, such as the worm or dragon Beowulf fought, and the phrase that does appear, Middle-earth. The tale is a great epic that contains many battles and heroic deeds. This will be frequently mentioned throughout this podcast. There are feasts and rewards and feats of massive strength. There are even stories within the story. The main character, Beowulf, is a Geat from a northern Scandinavian country. He hears of the plight of the Danes and sails to aid them. For 12 years, the Danes have been attacked by the monster Grendel. The king Hrothgar is worn and at his wit's end when Beowulf arrives. It is not entirely clear what exactly Grendel is, but there is a line. Grendel was the name of this grim demon haunting the marshes, marauding round the heath, and the desolate fens. He had dwelt for a time in misery among the banished monsters, Cain's clan, whom the Creator had outlawed and condemned as outcasts. This line actually tells the reader two things. First, many scholars believe it implies Grendel was of Cain's lineage. Yes, the very same Cain from the Bible who slew his brother Abel. It also shows there are strong Christian references in the tale. Beowulf was certainly an oral tale long before it was written down. There were also still fairly strong pagan beliefs among the Anglo-Saxons when the tale was created. Some scholars believe the Christian elements that we read now were not always present. When the tale was finally recorded, Christian symbols were probably put in to give the epic some acceptance among the clergy. If it strongly promoted paganism, it would have never been accepted and may well have never survived the centuries, but destroyed simply as heathen literature. Beowulf tells Hrothgar he will rid the Danes of the creature Grendel. And one night, when Grendel attacks, the two fight to the death. Of course, as befitting an epic, Beowulf is earlier described as the mightiest man on earth, high-born and powerful. Not only is he the strongest man in the world, but he's also of good birth. At this point in literature, most of the characters in tales were not the common man or the peasant, but usually nobles. Commoners could be loyal and aid a nobleman, as appears in other tales, but they were not the focus of the tale, and certainly not the hero. Just after Beowulf swears that he will defeat Grendel, a warrior of Hrothgar's court, Unferth, challenges him and tells of a swimming contest that Beowulf once lost. Beowulf turns right around and explains that while he may not have crossed the sea before his opponent Breca, he fought a greater battle. When Beowulf swam against Breca, he was the strongest swimmer, but after 5 nights of swimming, yes, 5 nights, while holding a sword and wearing chainmail, yes, it is unbelievable, but this is what it says, which he wore for protection, a sea monster came up and dragged him to the bottom of the sea. While he was under the sea for a whole night, he proceeded to kill 9 sea monsters and then drifted back to shore. As you can see, Beowulf is not your ordinary human. He was able to swim for 5 days, not float, but swim a race, a fast-paced race, for those 5 days. Then even after he exerted himself so much, he killed 9 fierce and ferocious sea monsters while completely underwater for a night. There's not too many people that I personally know of who can stay underwater for more than a few minutes without oxygen tanks, let alone hold their breath a whole night and exert themselves to fight off sea monsters. Beowulf will again demonstrate his amazing ability to hold his breath underwater when he later fights Grendel's mother. Counting on his mighty strength, Beowulf swears he will not use a sword against Grendel, but he will fight him in hand-to-hand combat. After their fight, Grendel was wounded and tried to get away, but Beowulf would not let go. He held on so tightly and was so incredibly strong that Grendel's arm literally ripped off at the shoulder. Grendel escaped, dying his lair under the waters. Grendel's mother later comes to avenge her son, and Beowulf follows her into her lair in the swamps. His sword would not penetrate her flesh. It's not exactly said why he suddenly decided to fight her with a sword. Maybe he kind of chickened out. Who knows? But eventually, after his sword wouldn't work, he had to fight her hand-to-hand just like he did her son. Finally, he comes upon a strange sword that just happens to be sitting in the lair. It is the only sword that will cut through Grendel's mother, and he hurries to the end of the battle. He then goes on to decapitate her and brought her head to Hrothgar as a trophy. He also brought the hilt of the sword that killed her to Hrothgar, for it's only the hilt that remains. Her blood was so acidic and poisonous that it literally melted the blade of the sword that killed her. The whole battle underwater in the swamps against Grendel's mother lasted 9 hours. Again, an amazing example of breath holding. All of this is actually just the first half of the epic. It really is an action-packed adventure that can capture the imagination of any child, and even any adult if they want to embark on it. The second half of the epic has Beowulf as the new king of the Geats, and back in his homeland, for now, his previous king Hygelac has passed on. There he goes on to fight a worm, or what we know now as a dragon, that is guarding a magnificent treasure. It is also the last battle for this great man. He is now an old man, but he is able to save his people in one final and amazing show of strength. I won't go into too much detail about the battle with the dragon, just because I do want people to read this for themselves. It is a very good tale. Now, aside from the wonderful battles and heroism, there are also a few lessons to be learned about honor in this tale. The warrior Unferth, who was mentioned earlier, who had challenged Beowulf's boasts, he's quickly shown to be a very dishonorable man. Beowulf explains how Unferth only boasts. He talks the talk, but he doesn't walk the walk. He never actually has the courage to fight with honor. In fact, Beowulf explains that he actually killed some of his own family, and he will be judged in the afterlife for it. Later, when Beowulf goes to fight the worm, the dragon at the end of the tale, the warriors that accompany him get scared and run off, leaving him on his own. They do not have the courage and the honor to stick it out and fight off this worm with him. Only one person remains by his side, a young boy named Wiglaf. He is not a great warrior, he's just a young boy. But for his loyalty and honor, Wiglaf is named Beowulf's successor and goes on to be the next king of the Geats. This is an example of how honor can actually pay off in the end. At times throughout the tale, other tales are told. When Beowulf and Hrothgar are feasting, a poet tells the tale of Sigemund and how he slew the dragon. This is another heroic tale from the Norse and Scandinavian areas. I'm not too familiar with the Scandinavian version, but I am quite familiar with the Germanic version for this discussion. Siegfried, the Germanic name, or Sigmund, the Norse name, slew the dragon that guarded the hoard, the treasure hoard. Beowulf is contrasted with King Heremond in this tale, who is a man past his prime and angry that others are mightier than him. He actually turns into a rather evil man because of jealousy and having no honor. He is not a rock for his people like Sigmund and Beowulf are. This subtale, while in Beowulf it's used to contrast the king and Beowulf, it can also be used to foresee Beowulf's own future. He, like Sigmund, goes on to defeat a dragon and return a great treasure to his people. If you follow the story of Sigmund, you will learn that the treasure is actually cursed. The same could be said for the treasure Beowulf uncovers. It was originally found by a peasant who ended up stealing a cup. This ended up bringing the dragon's wrath down upon Beowulf's people. The treasure was a catalyst, and the death of Beowulf was the outcome. Not a happy ending. Okay, I'm getting a little too much into Sigmund's tale, and that easily can be an episode in itself, so I'll stop here. But the point is, to the listener of Beowulf, who's sitting in the feast hall back in the so-called Dark Ages, he's hearing a new tale about this hero Beowulf. Yet, he's also hearing an old tale of Sigmund, which he may already know, probably already knows. The poet is connecting Beowulf with other great heroes in some of the lessons, such as heroism, that can be learned, and also some of the feats of strength that he manages. One of the reasons why Beowulf is a staple of early English studies is for the language it brings. This is pretty much the largest tale written in Old English. While there are histories that are longer, this is the longest piece of fiction that currently exists. At over 3,000 lines, it is an excellent resource for learning the language. Even to the casual reader, it can be an interesting etymological study. I am not well versed in the language, I've just glanced at it here and there, so I really will not attempt to slaughter it by reading a few lines. I will not do it any justice. But I have had professors who have read passages in class before, and it's wonderful to listen to. It doesn't flow as well as the Romance languages, such as French or Italian. It's a little more guttural, like German, a little harsher in its sounds. Even still, it has a wonderful rhythm and can be such a joy to listen to. So if you can get your hands on an audio file of Old English, check it out. It's rather worth it. You can also see the beginnings of our modern language in some of the words. I looked at my Old English grammar book and learned that the letters CG, when put together, are pronounced like the sound DG, J. Then I looked at the word spelled BRYCG. All of a sudden, this little light bulb went on and I realized what I was reading. BRYCG, pronounced by the old standards, is bridge. BRIDGE. Even after more than 1,000 years, some of our words are the same, just spelled a little different. But we've had words spelled differently over the past 100 or 200 years, so that isn't that different. There are also words that, while they've changed in English, German still uses the exact same spelling as the Old English version, such as B-E-T-T, bet, which in German is bed, and in the Old English it was bed. We've just, again, changed the spelling over the years. So far, in recapping this tale, this may sound more like a book review or book report, but in actuality, if you think about it, this is what people used to sit around and listen to. These were the tales that made up their culture and their history. And I won't get too much into it, but there has been studies on whether or not Beowulf was a historical figure. There might have been some king that happened to round up some treasures and defeat who could have been deemed a monster by his people, and he could have been the inspiration for Beowulf. Just like there's debates over whether or not King Arthur was real and if there were tribal kings that were an inspiration for his character. So, while this may just sound like a fictional tale to some of my listeners, it is a part of our history, and it is a part of their daily life. I apologize, I cannot provide a traveler's note for this episode, as I have not been fortunate enough to travel anywhere in Scandinavia. but I can still suggest a book. There are many translations of Beowulf. Some are highly reputable, some have been utterly trashed by the scholarly world as being horrible translations. There is J.R.R. Tolkien's translation, as mentioned before, and that has pretty good reviews. Yet the one that many reviewers are praising right now is actually a much newer version. It is translated by Seamus Heaney and was first published in 2000. Heaney uses a very lyrical style based on the Irish storytelling his family took part in. The book itself is actually split into two parts. On the left-hand pages, the Old English is written out, with the Modern English translation on the right. In the margins on the right, every page usually has one or two notes saying what section you are in, just a very brief two-line summary. It's a relatively easy read and quite enjoyable. There's also a little family tree in the back of the book which shows Beowulf and Hrothgar's lineage, so you can get an idea that they're both of noble families, that they have a lineage. That's pretty much it for this episode. You can check us out on the web at www.sportell.com/ancient, A-N-C-I-E-N-T, .html, or email us at history@sportell.com. We have now received a handful of emails, and they've been very encouraging, and I thank you very much. I'm always interested in ideas. I've actually received a few via emails now, and I am slowly building up my library in those subjects so that we can write on those subjects. And we're always eager for challenges on studying new areas and new time periods in ancient and medieval history. I would also like to mention that on the webpage, and this is not original, I've seen many other people do this, but I've added a Frapper map. I'm quite curious actually where people are that are listening to this. When I've checked out the subscription information or downloads, I've actually seen some from Italy, Philippines, Germany, Japan, the US, UK, a variety of different places. So I'm rather curious where everybody is listening from. So if you get a chance, go on the webpage and you'll actually see a link for Frapper Map, and by all means, add your name to it and where you live. Thank you very much. And I hope you will join us again next week.